My guest today is Rafiq Tanios. Some of you may know Rafiq from his previous appearance on the Hints for Healing podcast in episode 9 of season 1. Rafiq is an education and mental health professional and filmmaker who specializes in cross-cultural therapeutic interventions and intercultural learning. He has over 25 years of direct experience working locally and internationally in the roles of educator, counselor, and welfare worker with culturally and linguistically diverse communities. Presently, he's a school liaison counselor and project worker at STARTS, which is the New South Wales Service for the Treatment and Rehabilitation of Torture and Trauma Survivors. In this episode, Rafiq discusses how all forms of racism impact on the developing individual, and he highlights how schools can work together against racism and towards inclusion, belonging, and recovery for learners with refugee experience. Good morning, Rafiq, and welcome back to the Hints for Healing podcast.
Good morning, Nicole. Happy to be back.
Great to have you back. I had the pleasure of interviewing you back in April 2021 for the Hints for Healing podcast, where you spoke, of course, about intercultural learning, as well as a bit about your own personal history of migration to Australia from Egypt at age 5, and how your experiences of growing up in Australia influenced your work as a filmmaker and also as a mental health professional over the last 25 years or so. And of course, you and I are co-producing this season on combating racism in schools, and we thought it would be great to have you back on the show to bring together some of what's been discussed in the previous podcasts in this season and to share some of your insights on the impact of all forms of racism, so the systemic, the institutional, interpersonal and personal racism on the developing individual. And we also wanted to have you here to highlight where the opportunities are for combating racism in schools. So just to start, Rafiq, in your experience, what are some of the precursors to institutional and interpersonal racism occurring in schools that you've noticed?
Okay, so I guess what we have to recognise is that schools are a part of society and they're part of a historical structure. So whatever's in our ecology, whatever's in our social institutions, whatever's happened in our history is also going to play out in schools. So schools are institutions that have a history, that are affected by the past. We didn't create the past, but we are affected by it. And therefore, in schools, you have all the elements that you have in a society. So whether that's relationships of power and subordination, whether that's particular values, they'll all be expressed in the institution. They'll be expressed through traditions, and they'll also be expressed through the practices, and they'll be expressed through the behaviours of individuals in the institution. So that means that the inherited relationships of subordination and from the past. So if we just take, for example, the impact of colonization in this country and the marginalization of Indigenous people, Australia's First Nations, there's going to be elements of those processes and practices in schools. And even now, education is struggling with, you know, there's a sort of a contested platform at the moment around what can be taught to kids about the history of this country. And we have the Conservative parties wanting to limit access to information that represents the history of First Nation people and focus on, I guess, what they call the people and events stuff, the glorification of, early settlement and colonization. So no matter what you do, schools are part of society and they're going to play out the same issues that occur in society. So in that sense, between learners in the curriculum, between teachers and between all of the relationships in the school, there's going to be elements of what we see in society and what we've inherited from the past.
Yeah, and Rafiq, I know you've got so many years of experience across so many schools, including rural and regional schools across New South Wales. And of course, we've noticed many schools, even if they're really multicultural, some have been extremely successful in cultivating such a great culture of celebrating multiculturalism, tolerance, respect, What have you noticed are some of the elements that contribute to these really inclusive schools?
Yeah, I think there are many elements, and my feedback will be anecdotal. I think we still need to go to the evidence base to check on what actually, you know, what the actual practices are. But I think just from my observations, it starts with leadership. You know, if the leadership is responsive, inclusive, and open, there's always opportunity for people to raise issues and to innovate around the needs of learners. And if it's an open environment, an inclusive environment for staff, that I think is often reflected in the relationships with learners. I think it really requires a very intentioned approach. It's not accidental. Schools that that succeed at these things are able to mobilise the resources they have. So those members of their staff group who have an interest and skills or a vision for inclusivity, they have a commitment to the learning body. They understand their learners. They may empathise and see the needs of their learners as human needs rather than sort of focusing on a very narrow perspective on behaviour and learning. They might see them as people who come to a school community and part of the community. So I think opportunities in regional schools, there seems sometimes to be more of a community focus or a community connection, simply because people are more invested because they live closer, they live in a more connected way. And I think what I've seen really work is when, particularly with learners with refugee experience, when there's a teacher who can see the importance of attachment as the foundation of all the relationships and learning that happen in school and can cultivate a nurturing attachment relationship in their own personal relationship with the learners, but across the school, I think that really is the safest and most responsive environment to the needs of learners and the most responsive environment when conflicts turn up, because conflicts do turn up in all schools. There's racial conflicts in all schools. But often what happens is they're either ignored, not understood, dismissed, and people feel, I think, ashamed and afraid and don't know what to do in that space. But if there's an attachment relationship, if there's a commitment to the learners for their recovery, and there's a focus on their development and the relationships they forge as part of the recovery with teachers and with the school, there's generally a more nurturing, responsive environment when something does come up, and it can be handled in a much more responsive and effective way for the learners.
Right. I love how you explained that, Rafiq, and I couldn't agree more. I've seen it as well. So that basis of the strong attachment, and then I guess hand in hand with that goes the appreciation of the whole person, as you said, and nurturing the needs of the whole person. And then I think what comes alongside that is that unconditional positive regard that the student feels, that even when their behaviour isn't consistent with what's expected of them in a school context, they know that teacher is still there for them, knows that they just weren't showing their best colours that day and is there to nurture them even through some of their most difficult behaviours. Yeah, and that link to community as well that you mentioned, I think, is so important, and I can see why that shines through even stronger in smaller communities where you're very familiar with. So what are some of the ways that young people do respond to being subject to institutional racism in schools and also interpersonal racism?
Well, I think if we just focus on learners with refugee experience first and think about how learners with refugee experience have, I guess, been exposed to things beyond their control. And often if it's a chronic exposure, there's trauma, significant trauma, often in the individuals, perhaps in the family systems, and even in the community. So we already have a community that has been exposed to sometimes systemic oppressive behaviours that might be targeted at their identity or at their political affiliation, or their religious group. And that's going to be something that's going to be extra sensitive. We might say there's already a vulnerability present because of that exposure and because of those experiences, and sometimes the historical experiences, say, is for the Yazidi community. Now, when they arrive in Australia, if we understand that vulnerability, what that tells us is that something like racism, depending on the protective factors that that community experiences in settlement, if there are diminished protective factors, let's say for that family or for that individual, then racism finds a very fertile ground that presents as a comorbidity. It begins to take hold because it's another layer, of something beyond the control of the person that goes to their identity. Because racism is a very visceral bodily experience for people who experience it. It's about something you can't change about yourself. And then it becomes something negative. It's represented negatively. So when you look in the mirror of society, what you see back, what comes back to you, is something awful. It's a disfigurement of who you are. So it has a profound effect on development, but it also has a profound effect on already vulnerable people. So I think we really need to be aware that learners with refugee experience are more susceptible to the vulnerabilities around racism. And we might say that goes the same for First Nation people, Aboriginal learners in our communities as well, that because of the history of colonization, because of the unfinished business and treaty, that there may be also high levels of vulnerability for those children. So I think once we recognize that, if we care and if we're motivated and if we know how, we can begin a strategy of making sure that there's an environment that's open and listening and responsive to the needs of those learners. And I really like what you highlighted when you made that commentary earlier about that aspect of attachment, which is being seen, and the unconditional positive regard. And I always think of the silent face experiment, where the mother just stops interacting with the child for a few seconds and already the child becomes distressed. Children and young people need to have mirrored back to them a joy in their company, and not a disfigured mirror, but a positive mirror of who they are. And that's going to build healthy humans. So I think it's really important that we actually have an intention strategy to address those things when they come up in schools.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Rafiq. And what sort of beliefs about themselves are young people with refugee experience at risk of developing if they're consistently the subject of racism, whether institutional or interpersonal?
So, we learn about ourselves from the outside in. I think there's one commentator who said, I can't remember who it is to give credit to, but and I think that's a really important thing to think about with children, that what they're learning about themselves when they're exposed to chronic racism and without protective factors, is that they're not good enough, that they're interpolated or expected to fill a role, a racialized role, that's inferior to other people. And what happens is, I think what drives the behavior then is a need for respect, because that's what they've experienced, this disrespect at a very visceral level. So, it plays out in different ways for different people, but, that means young people are going to seek validation, going to seek respect. And if they can't achieve that within a school environment, they might be able to achieve that in some other context. It may play out in antisocial ways, because that key need to be seen and to develop a positive sense of self isn't being fed. So I think, there are many problems that emerge for children and young people, because they're in that critical phase of developing who they are as human beings, and they don't have the data to make sense of the world they're in, they can't identify that what they're dealing with is something from the past that they have no control over, that racism is something that's in our society as a way of thinking and talking and treating people. They don't know that. They don't have that data to be able to say, it's nothing wrong with me. It's actually what's going on over here. And so it becomes an integral part of their sense of self. And it has all of the trauma presentations that, you know, we're aware of, you know, textbook stuff. It means that they develop a perceptual bias towards survival. They begin to be afraid of personal interactions. There may be avoidance behaviors of those things that feel unsafe because of their racial experiences. So it really shrinks your world. Racism shrinks opportunities. It shrinks your world and has a profound effect on your relationships with other human beings. So we don't want that to happen, because that doesn't lead to a healthy and productive society that we can all thrive in. It leads to pockets of depression and anxiety and self-harm. And I think that's something we really have to be aware of in terms of its impact.
I found that really interesting what you said about seeking respect being a driver of behavior. And it struck me as something that might be a potentially useful lens for educators to use when they're encountering difficult behaviors amongst their students with refugee experience. So if we use that lens for a little while, how can we see that search for respect playing out in behaviors, and how young people make choices, how they make decisions? Can we flesh that out a little bit more?
Yeah, so some young people, I mean, there are a few concepts that can help us make sense of this. You have the first one, which deals with, I guess, social acculturation and integration. And we know that if you're learning makes you ashamed of your cultural background, and if your cultural background appears to you as powerless in the society you live in, right? So for many children coming here, their parents are diminished. Their parents, if they've come as refugees or have refugee-like experiences, their parents may not have access to resources in their first couple of years, and they may not be coping very well. So they may not know stuff. And as a child, you may start to know stuff faster than your parents. So they begin to be diminished. And that can, you know, if there's cultural shame attached to your experiences in the classroom or at school, if there's a lack of inclusivity in society you live in, that's going to transfer. And so you may reject your own cultural background in terms of your identity. Now, if you experience racism as well, then you're already being rejected from that more powerful cultural context that you might be wanting to be part of and be attracted to. And so that plays out in different ways. You can really internalize that racism and turn on people from your own community, or people who you think are also, you can become, I guess we call it lateral violence, but play out a racist approach to other people who are also diminished in their relationships in society. And it's really the worst outcome when people are disconnected from the host culture and from their own culture, from their ancestral culture and from the host culture, because they have nowhere to belong. And so they're the people we know, the research tells us, are the most vulnerable to exploitation, to things like terrorism. I mean, they're really the victims of this kind of problematic relationship with acceptance and welcoming and attachment in our society. So it does have a profound impact on where people end up and how they behave. In other ways, you know, it could be as simple as, you know, kids doing, you know, if you're constantly told that your behavior is bad, or you belong to a group that's behavior is bad, as a child or as a young person, you might actually feel interpolated, feel called to play that out and to be that sort of person. And that could play out in, you know, in low-level sort of criminal activities and develop further, because already you're being told that you don't belong to a group that's celebrated. And so people can embrace this alternate identity if it offers them respect in other ways, or if it offers them validation in other ways, or if it offers them connection in other ways, or family in other ways. So, you know, I'm just thinking of, you know, young people who, if you think back to Vietnamese young people as refugees in Cabramatta many years ago, and some of those young people who were rejected by their families or had family conflict because of the refugee experience and weren't able to survive in society, found community in gang relationships. That was their family. And the only way they could survive was in living in a sort of an underbelly of society because they were rejected from mainstream society. And it was really like poignant back then. You know, Cabramatta was called Vietnamatta. They were called rubbish. They were, you know, there was so much media representation and rejection in from the community and from host culture that, you know, what played out there was really tragic and part of those systemic forces that we talk about, that there wasn't a proper inclusion strategy, there wasn't proper support for people who were suffering when they arrived.
What have you noticed has changed since for young people that are noticing that need for some support, for teachers that are recognising it in their students, what's improved and what barriers are still there for students needing support when they're not feeling that inclusion in their school and broader society?
Yeah, that's a good question. I can only speak on some of the experiences that have come to me. And, you know, for young people who are refugees and black, there's some real challenges, I think. You know, there's kind of a hierarchy of race. It plays out differently in different ways. So, you know, Australian racism has that flavour of, it can play out against, you know, Chinese or Asian looking, or it could play against Middle Eastern or, you know, or Muslim seeming, and it can play out against, you know, for African kids or black kids, it plays out in different ways as well. But I think it's still quite challenging sometimes for young people because they experience a sort of hyper-surveillance. What they experience is, it's like a monkey on their back, you know, that they've got to always make sure they're doing the right thing or assimilating correctly. And I think that's quite systemic in many ways. So it happens in public spaces. It happens through a private gaze, not just an institutional gaze. And so what I think is different is that sometimes now I notice people can articulate that better, like young people. I don't know if it's social media. I don't know if it's, but they, in my conversations, I've noticed that they can tell you something's wrong, you know, and they can tell you that what they feel about what's going on. And actually their instincts are so spot on, you know, they can really, it's never incorrect. What they're picking up on is our subtle relationships of power and subordination. And, you know, often perpetrators don't realize they're behaving that way towards them. And so I think to resource those young people, we need to give them language to describe what's happening to them. There needs to be kind of a racial literacy around what's going on and the resources to sustain themselves in those situations, to kind of understand that it's not actually about them, that it's an inherited aspect of society. There needs to be a lot of support for young people, just to support them and nurture them, so when these things come up, they have a way of being resistant or inoculized, really, to the impacts of the visceral impacts of racism on them. So that would be my sense of how things are at the moment. I was just going to say the most significant barrier is, of course, denial and dismissing what people tell you, you know, because people are afraid to deal with it. They don't like dealing with racism. There's an unfinished business in our history. We haven't come to terms, right? So in our society, it's going to be angst provoking no matter where you are or who you are. And I think that's a major problem in dealing with it effectively.
Yeah, you certainly don't want to be a victim, but you also don't want to be a perpetrator. And there is a lot of angst around that. And I want to pick up on what you said about perpetrators of racism often being very unaware of the impact that their behaviour and words has on others. And it's something that I encountered as well, mainly when I was doing research in this space in the private rental market and interviewing lots of real estate agents and landlords. And a lot of what they were saying made it really clear that they were unaware of the impact of their practices and certainly didn't want to be in that group of, you know, making life so much difficult for newly arrived migrants and refugees to Australia. So I was wondering if you can comment on what schools can do in that space to support also young people who you know, want to be inclusive, but may inadvertently be, contributing to the problem of racism in schools. And I suppose, among staff as well, who want to be more aware and more helpful in that space.
I think there's an excellent push at the moment, this year with the Department of Education in New South Wales, and it's probably leading the country in terms of its understanding of race and its impact and its approach to trying to develop racial literacy. So there are really positive things happening with our partners in education. I think I always like to answer that at the personal level, because what I mean is that people, racism is a set of ways of talking about people. It's a way of thinking about people. It's a way of treating people. So it plays out in very many different ways, because it's knowledge, it's discourse, it's behaviour, and without a community, like without a racial literacy that we all sort of understand and can talk about, you can't really address the issues, because often what you're dealing with are historical beliefs, or social beliefs, or family beliefs, and they're invisible to you. And no person who engages in racist behaviour is generally happy to believe that they're racist. And when someone who engages in racist behaviour is confronted with it, I've never met someone who would say, yes, I did, that was racist and I did it, because it's so shameful, right? And because we know how awful it is, what's happened, slavery and dispossession. And so I think people would never be able to own it, So what we have to work on is hearing the experiences of people who suffer or are the objects of racism, because if we can hear their voices and amplify what they tell us, that might speak to our minds and hearts. That might help us begin to understand how our actions or our thoughts or our utterances, our narratives are affecting them. And we can start small at that level, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have anti-racism strategies or anti-racism learning. I think that's really important and valuable as well. But it's the personal journey, actually, I feel, that is where it starts. And it has to come from that space of seeing value in the people that we work with or that we engage with. We have to see something about them that we like or love. We have to find something in them. It's that positive regard you're referring to, where we're willing to hear. And I think everyone has a capacity for that. I think every human and every professional has a capacity for that. On a good day, they should be able to have a capacity to hear what's going on for someone else, particularly if that person's in my care or I'm in a relationship of power or management of that individual, because that's going to make me better at what I do, and it's going to make their world better. So I think that personal capacity to be open, it's a really, it's part of reflective practice, I guess, but it's also a personal kind of attribute where you can learn from what you hear and reflect on your own behaviours and what you've done. And I think that can really make a difference. I heard a woman recently talking about this in the United States, and she was saying that she'd always understood issues of racism And then she was talking with a friend about where his child was going to school, and it was a really great school, but it was in a state where, you know, there was some violence towards his community. And she was like, this is going to be great. And he was like, well, I'm a bit concerned. And she was really surprised about his concern. And she said it was the first time she realized how different their experiences were, because she didn't even, you know, if her child got into that school, she wouldn't even think about the safety of her child. It wasn't even on the radar. But this parent was anxious about whether this child would encounter, you know, violence and threat to life in his journey to education. So, you know, people who suffered racism or systemic oppression, their view of the world is different to those of us who haven't. And so it's kind of like talking in a language often that we don't see their reality, their view. So it's by beginning that journey of learning and listening that we can modify our own expectations and our own understandings of other people's realities.
Look, you've covered so much already in the short time we've had together. And look, I do have one final question. If you feel you've covered it already, that's fine. But I was wondering, reflecting on your experiences with individual students who've encountered racism at schools, can you speak in general terms about positive experiences where they've been able to overcome the impact of racism? There's been a shift in the school environment. What are some of the factors that help to recover from these experiences?
Okay, so I guess what I would like to say is that we need to see the racist experiences as just, I guess, let's say, events in a long continuum of experiences. And our focus is better served by being directed at how do we set up a continuum of support and nurturing. Because when those events happen, if we've got that continuum of support and nurturing, when those events appear, we can then deal with them within a context that's already designed to lift kids up. And it's that, again, it's that, it goes back to attachment. It goes back to, do I feel seen by my teacher? Do I feel included? Does my teacher know something about me? Does my teacher enjoy my company, right? So, you know, I mean, I think all of us who've worked as educators try to find something in every learner, in our community of learners, that shows them that we can see them, because they need that. It's teaching is an emotional labor, and it's built on attachment. It doesn't work if people don't feel connected and safe. So if we have those foundations in place, right, even if we don't know how to deal with racism, we're going to be open when someone raises an issue with us. We're going to be listening, because already we have all of the key attachment characteristics in place. The person is seen, we're responsive to their needs, we're consistent, and we have positive regard. So then I think nearly everyone struggles with a strategy to respond to racism because it's complex. But we can nut that out. You know, you can contact STARTS and we can give you some support. We can give you advice. We can help you navigate that response so that it's a response that's restorative rather than punitive. So the people who experienced it have a voice, but the people who were perpetrators are also supported in understanding, like growing from that experience, not necessarily shamed and punished. We want them to understand the impact, and maybe that these are things that they never thought about, they've inherited from the past, but that hurts them as well as hurts the people that they, you know, that it's impacted on. It's you know, there is a way to do this intelligently and with care, but I think people often may not have the knowledge or the experience, or may just be afraid. And so we can assist with that. But that's always built on that foundation of care and attachment and nurturing. It can't work. It can't work otherwise. Like responding to a single racist event, if you don't have all of those things in place, it doesn't work. It just becomes an institutional response. And you might be able to tick off some boxes, but it hasn't achieved anything for anyone.
I think that reducing shame, as you say, is so important to reduce that hypersensitivity. It's something that as a society, every society, unfortunately, is affected by that. But it's, how we respond to it. Rafiq, if you have nothing else to add, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on the show again today and for all your contributions to this season. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nicole.